silence is commanded.
Before we begin with our afternoon case, I have a couple of things. First of all, my notes tell me that students from Stoughton High School may be here. If they are, would they please stand? Oh, wonderful. Terrific. You may be seated. We're very happy to have you here. Did you have a chance to be here for Justice Shirley Abrahamson's presentation at lunch?
No.
Didn't have a chance to do that.
They missed it, but I'll be happy to talk to them afterwards if they can stay after this argument.
Okay, that's a great offer. So you can let our marshal, Kevin Pond, know if you can stay, and if you can, then Justice Abrahamson, so we'll come and chat with you a little bit. The students are here on a program called Court with Class that we do in coordination with the State Bar of Wisconsin. Now, that was one little matter. Also, the schedule is a little different today for how you're breaking up the time. So I'm going to go over what I have, and if what I have is not correct, it's worth correcting me, okay? So we're going to start out with 25 minutes with Attorney Lindner, and then we'll have, this is interesting, 12 and a half minutes with Attorney Brown, and then we'll have another 12 and a half minutes with Attorney Myalik, thank you very much. And then we'll have 5 minutes with Attorney Shampoo.
Shampoo.
Say it again.
Shampoo.
Shampoo, thank you very much. And then back with you, Attorney Lindner, for 5 minutes. All right, very good. Are you prepared to proceed? Okay. Be sure the microphone is advantageously fixed for you. We've been having trouble hearing this morning. So.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, may it please the court. My name is Laura Lindner, and I represent the petitioner in this matter, Wisconsin Bell, Inc. I know you had arguments this morning about the deference issue. I think in this case, the court doesn't even need to address the three levels of review. LIRC's position in this case, from its initial decision to its positions through every level of appeal up until this court, has been very inconsistent, and their interpretation of the statute is very unreasonable. So I think that means that this court can and should look at the statutory interpretation, in this case, de novo.
So since it's inconsistent, which one is consistent with your position? Did they ever take a position consistent?
They have not taken a position that's
What's
consistent.
What's your position?
What LIRC has finally conceded is that intent is required to establish a claim of because of disability discrimination. But LIRC takes the position that intentional discrimination can be proven merely through what they call an inference method or a syllogism, where they say, if an employee engaged in some conduct caused by a disability and that conduct led to a discharge or other adverse action, it must be then that the employee was terminated because of the disability. And
is that really the definition of the inference method? Let me tell you what I read from what they wrote. I read that in order to be fired because of your disability, the employer has to have knowledge of the disability. The knowledge is important because that's why LIRC said, no, there's no problem with the suspension that occurred for 50 days. They didn't have knowledge at that time. So for the last problem where he did get discharged, so you have to have knowledge, and the conduct that caused you to be discharged has to be a result of your disability. So knowledge and a nexus with the conduct. That's what I hear him saying.
They are saying that, but what's absent in this case is the causal connection between the conduct and the condition. They haven't specifically established that in this case the particular conduct that led to termination was caused by the bipolar disorder.
Well, is that a factual determination or a legal determination?
It's a factual determination.
Don't we give them substantial deference for factual findings unless they're clearly erroneous?
In this case, it is clearly erroneous.
Okay. All right.
On that issue, Your Honor, there's agreement among all the parties that if you have a non-obvious medical condition like this one, bipolar disorder, which is a very complex mental health condition, mm-hmm. all the parties agree that you have to have objective medical proof of the causal connection between the conduct and the mental health condition. You have to have medical proof.
And you don't think the statements of his doctor that his acting out at work and doing things inconsistent with a known policy of the employer, you don't think those statements are sufficient to show that there was a nexus between his disability and his conduct?
Correct, because okay. The letters that Wisconsin Bell had merely established that the employee had bipolar disorder and then just generally described some of the symptoms and behaviors associated with that.
Yeah.
In this particular case...
Wasn't there additional testimony and evidence taken after the suspensions, the two suspensions, and the second one being the second suspension and termination? Wasn't there additional evidence gathered to show, to link up the causal connection?
There was not before that determination was made. There were depositions.
I know. That's why my question is after that.
No. There were two letters in connection with the hang-up incident, and then there was another letter from the psychiatrist after the...
The 40-minute.
Before the final determination was made. But that letter, again, merely said, I'm reaffirming that you have bipolar disorder.
So there's nothing else in the record before or after the termination. That's what you're... Same?
The only thing in the record after the termination would be the depositions of the treaters in the litigation case. But there's nothing in the record that establishes before the termination.
So what came up after? What came up after to establish the causal connection?
Nothing to the knowledge of the employer.
Nothing to what?
Nothing to the knowledge of the employer who made the decision.
What came up after? That's a simple question.
Just depositions of the treaters in discovery. That was it.
All right. Well, didn't they explain that the
right.
conduct that you were observing as an employer was caused by his mental condition?
They attempted to say that. It's our position that one of the doctors, particularly the psychiatrist, was a little vague on that. But again, that was not information known to the employer.
He got suspended pending termination, so the deal wasn't done when he was told you're at least off for now, correct?
He was suspended pending termination.
Right.
And it wasn't until this review board proceeding, which he gets under his collective
right.
bargaining agreement, that he handed over a letter that again right. says, you have bipolar disorder, but you've been doing better, you know, here's your medication. He turns that letter over. That letter does not say, and in my opinion...
We all know this.
Okay.
But you didn't put on any expert testimony on behalf of Wisconsin Bell. Why didn't you have your own expert ask to examine him and have your expert say, no, what he's doing doesn't have anything to do with his disability?
We might have had to do that if we were before you on an accommodation case, but there is no reasonable accommodation claim before the court. The claim before the court is, did Wisconsin Bell terminate him because of his disability?
That's correct.
Well, I'm asking you... No. And you seem to be taking the position that you get to decide what's relevant, and you're not right on that. If you want to not answer my question the fourth and last time I'm going to ask you, I don't care. But I want to know. And the question is, what came out at the deposition? I understand the timing of the deposition, and I understand what the supervisors knew and didn't know. I know what the letters said prior to termination. You understand that, right?
I do, and I apologize,
okay.
Your Honor.
And so my question is, what was the causal? I don't remember from reading the, what was the causal connection that was linked up at the deposition following the termination?
So the therapist testified that the bipolar disorder could cause impulsivity, overreaction to certain events. The psychiatrist testified to some similar behaviors. But they didn't say, and it's our opinion that he did these particular things because of that disorder.
Okay, so they never linked up the general manifestations with the specific incidents from 2010 and 2011. Now, I also want to ask you, at the 2011 one with the 40-minute health code, or health, whatever it was called, now he was upset, the employee was upset because he had not passed a test that would have allowed him eligibility to go on to a different job, and he was instant messaging, my recollection is, with fellow employees, and some of them were commiserating with him, and he was suggesting to one of his fellow employees that she go check her test results, her test scores. And then there was another series of exchanges where he was going back and forth on the instant messaging with a union rep, with his union rep, to find out, okay, if I leave now, if I depart from the call center, is it going to be an occurrence, or is it going to be a tardy? And he convinced what apparently was an accurate understanding of what the impact of both would be on his disciplinary. Now, I recall something about testimony or evidence later being introduced. It was post-termination evidence, but I'm asking you to tell me or remind me, fill in the gaps. I just forgot to look it up, and I forgot to ask my law clerks before I came out here. There was evidence that was adduced that he said, though, after he left, that he went to go see, I don't think he went to see, yeah, that there was a psychiatrist and there was a psychologist. And he did say that after he left the call center on that 2011 incident, that he went to go see, I believe, the psychologist. Was that established? Did that ever come out that he went to try? Because part of it was he was so, you know.
He didn't tell the company that in the review board proceeding, but he testified that, yes, he went home and he called his therapist and made an appointment for the next day or day after.
I see.
But okay. He did not say when the review board happened, oh, and after this happened, I immediately called my therapist and talked to him and, you know, made an appointment. In the review board proceeding, he talked again very generally about, I was upset, I reached out to coworkers for support. And importantly, those types of reactions are not unique to bipolar disorder. I mean, that's normal human reaction to failure. If somebody fails a test for a job that they want, they're going to be disappointed. They could be distracted. They might not want to do their job. They might prefer to go home. But none of that should have told the employer. You should assume, because you were told months ago in connection with incidents of hanging up on customers, that you should have assumed that that was also due to bipolar disorder. That's exactly what the statute doesn't want employers to do, is to make those kinds of assumptions. And so when you look at the record before the company, and this goes to the honest belief rule, which applies when you're looking at intentional discrimination. You have a situation where, okay, behavior is not unique to bipolar disorder. Behaviors that are normal human reactions. People react that way in the workplace all the time. You have a situation where he does go to his supervisor and says, you know, I'm thinking of leaving. I'm not doing well. What are the disciplinary consequences to me if I leave? And she said, well, you would just get written up. You wouldn't get suspended. He goes back and he confirms that with his union steward. Meanwhile, he's chatting, Q-chatting simultaneously with 15 different coworkers. The messages are mostly coherent. There's often
one of the difficulties of the intersection, and you're talking to a bench that has several members on it. Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, for instance, I believe was a circuit court judge for a decade. I was a judge for 10 years. Justice Annette Ziegler was a circuit court judge for 10 years. familiar with the dynamic, and the rest of the bench is familiar from different ways. But that's always been the difficulty of dealing, of using the court system to address issues of mental illness. And that is what you're saying, what you're describing, and what is similar to what I read, what we all read in preparation for this, what you're describing is almost always the case. I mean, unless someone just has a psychic break or something, and they think, you know, the rapture is here, the aliens have come, there's always sort of a mixture of sort of normal or even maybe exaggerated, but still within the realm of what most people consider normal reaction. And the question is, where does the ramped up, but still within the bounds of normal, leave off? And where does the effect of mental illness come in? So you're here to sell us on the idea that everything he did during those days, especially the last one, I suppose, which is what you're focusing on, the last chance agreement being the one implicated. And you're going to say, look, he was acting rationally and reasonably as one who was trying to protect his own self-interest by checking with the union rep. He asked the supervisor, you know, about the timing. He used the information that he gathered from the supervisor accurately. He accurately reported that to the union rep. And so all of this, you're saying, there's no way that that management would have been put on notice that he was suffering effects of mental illness.
Well, I think two things, Your Honor, and I understand the challenges of what you raised in terms of mental health, because it is a difficult diagnosis and sometimes difficult to discern whether something's normal behavior as opposed to something caused by a disorder. I mean, the law looks at in terms of aberrant behavior, is the person acting differently than they have otherwise acted in the workplace. And in this particular context, bless you, Your Honor, what I think is important is Mr. Carlson had gone through this before. He had put the company on notice with regard to the hang-ups. I have bipolar disorder. He could have very easily, when he went to the supervisor to say, what are the disciplinary consequences of me leaving early, said, okay, I'm freaking out right now because I didn't pass this test, and here's what's going on. He didn't say that to her then. He didn't say that to her the next day when she sat down with him and his union steward and got the cue messages and talked about those. And he didn't raise it when he was given notice of his suspension pending termination. He only raises it at the 11th hour at the review board, at which time he turns over yet another doctor's note just saying, you have bipolar disorder, it's actually improved a bit. We'll keep your medications at this level.
Did the company ever offer, does the record demonstrate whether the company ever offered him an avenue by which you're saying he never came forward and said, okay, you know that bipolar depressive disorder that I had to disclose to you after the 2010 incident? I'm experiencing some adverse effects that have been brought on by this tough news about not having made the grade for the test. You know, all of us who've worked, and I'm not talking about in nice law firms or government offices, but maybe if, like me, you worked your way through school in a factory or some other environment where they're perhaps less inclined to be indulgent towards the employee's personal difficulties. You can certainly see the power discrepancy in the real world between the employer and the employee. Did the employer ever, once Mr. disclosed this condition. Did they ever try to come up with a plan or to say, here's going forward, obviously this can be a stressful job. Dealing with the public can be very stressful, as we all know. Did they ever come up with a plan or idea of what he should do or who he should reach out to if he had another problem?
Well, at the end of the first review board meeting, when he was suspended pending termination for hanging up on customers, the labor relations manager said, because the union had asked for him to be brought back to work in recognition of his seniority, and the labor relations manager said, if we bring you back to work and you need an accommodation, here's what you need to do, but we're not going to allow as an accommodation hanging up on customers.
Was that Carl, Mr. Carl?
That was Peggy Teixeira.
Okay.
And he came back to work and then never said to any of his supervisors, okay, I'm back and this could, you know, this kind of thing could happen
well,
again.
A reasonable accommodation is never doing something that is contrary to a rule that anybody else would get fired for, right? So if Sally Smith next to him that has the same job did what he did, he would get fired, correct? Or she would get fired. But
right.
You can't ask for a reasonable accommodation not to have to do the job.
Correct.
Okay, but could he have asked for a reasonable accommodation to be put in another position within Wisconsinville?
He could have, and he was somebody who had used their accommodation process before for ergonomic work adjustments. He had taken leaves of absence. So he admitted, and the record is clear, that he knew the process to get accommodation and had taken advantage of it previously.
So asking to go home, just I'm too freaked out, I can't stay here, that's not a request for an accommodation, right?
That's not a request for accommodation in this scenario because he didn't say, and it's a medically, this is a medical situation. He just left, and he did it knowing he was going to have some disciplinary consequence from it. Whether it was either going to be, if it was an occurrence, a suspension, or a tardy, it was a suspension, or an occurrence, it was going to be a written warning. And so he knew it was disciplinary. He never then offered any medical excuse to get that covered by the FMLA or some other.
Well, maybe he thought that his employer knew because you have given him accommodations under the FMLA for time off that he needed to take because of this problem.
But in that situation, he has to provide medical. He knew the process. He needs to provide medical excuses and those kinds of
okay.
things.
All right. Thank you.
Counsel, paragraphs 55, 56, 57 of the Court of Appeals opinion take Wisconsin Bell to task, essentially, for not offering any expert opinion or just basing its decision, quote, simply, Wisconsin Bell chose not to believe Mr. Carlson without giving any consideration to the information from its health care providers. Earlier you were asked about what happened in terms of the deposition testimony. In paragraph 56 it says this, 55, Lurk found that Carlson's conduct was consistent with the symptoms in the letters that he had given to them from his health care providers. These findings were supported by deposition testimony from Dr. Siegel and Mr. Cohen. Both indicated that Mr. Carlson's conduct in engaging in Q-chatting with coworkers upon finding out that he had failed the collections department exam was indicative of his bipolar condition. For example, Mr. Cohen pointed out, in comparing the reactions to such news between people with and without mental illness, there's generally a difference in severity. Additionally, Dr. Siegel noted that based on the Q-chat content, Mr. Carlson seemed, quote, frantic, unquote, and was, quote, searching out people, unquote, to, quote, help him through a difficult time. Dr. Siegel further testified that these symptoms exhibited by Mr. Carlson were consistent with bipolar. So how do you refute that, or what did you put on to refute that testimony and the findings?
So we didn't have an expert witness, but I think if the company had been confronted with a letter that actually made the link between the conduct and the bipolar disorder, the company would have been in a different position. Because then arguably the company is being told that there is a causal connection here. The letters didn't do that. We're also not dealing with an accommodation case. in which case objective medical evidence is necessary. Now, this is not in the record, but we did talk to...
I don't want things...
I mean, we did talk to an expert, but...
If it's not in the record, then
necessarily
we don't
be able to give an opinion.
Counsel, is there a difference between being able to draw a causal link between the disorder and the behavior after the fact versus what the employer perceives during the fact, right? So the employer has to understand for this to constitute intent to discriminate, has to understand that the activity is a consequence of the disorder, right?
That's fundamentally our point. We didn't have that information at the time we were making these decisions. That was developed after the fact in litigation.
Well, findings of fact number 19 of LIRP says that Carl, who was a supervisor who was involved in this termination, had doctor's letters that they were given April 3rd, 2010, about his condition and what might be expected. And he gave them another letter on May 9th, 2011, which was consistent with the earlier letters, and that's another finding of fact that's made by LIRP. We have to agree with those findings, don't we?
Those letters, though, just say, here's the condition and here's how it can be manifested. If you look at LIRP's decision in the Mader case and the Court of Appeals decision in the Walmart case, in those decisions, both LIRP and the Court of Appeals say there has to be an medical proof giving a specific opinion as to the conduct and the disorder, linking that specifically up.
And you don't think the deposition testimony was sufficient to do that?
I don't think it was sufficient, but it also came after the fact. The company did not have that evidence to consider at the time it was making its decision.
Well, they may not have had that evidence because you don't usually have a doctor that you can just call up and say, would you please send me a letter today that explains what I'm doing is consistent with my decision. And isn't that, I mean, I may not understand Wisconsin Bell's process, but I thought he was suspended pending termination to give everybody a chance to look at what really occurred there and why. And that's why you had the hearing, right?
And he had the opportunity then to get a letter, and he could have gotten his doctor, he could have told his doctor, look, here's what happened at work, here's what I did, can you give me a letter about this, and can you offer an opinion as to whether what I did was caused by my conduct?
Well, he's not a lawyer, so I wouldn't expect that he would say, can you give me an opinion to a reasonable degree of medical certainty, which is the words we all love to see. So, that part of it doesn't concern me. I guess I'm trying to line up findings of fact that were made by LIRP with the depositions that Justice Gabler talked to you about, where there was a lot of conversation with one of his treating therapists, and come out, as you are, with saying, no, there wasn't any proof that his conduct was caused by his disability.
But the differentiator is timing, which is what did the employer know at the time the employer made the decision? The causal connection was fleshed out in depositions. It was not made clear in those letters.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is John Brown, and I represent the Labor and Industry Review Commission. Let me start, just for clarification, with the point Justice Gableman was making. The deposition testimony of the psychologist, Mr. Cohn, after the fact, but linking up the conduct that caused the discharge with Mr. Carlson's disability. Quote, he realized that he wasn't able to, evidently, and left work and was trying to find out what the consequences of leaving work would be because at that time, he felt that the only way to manage himself was to actually take a medical leave that day. A professional opinion based on the objective measures that are listed in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, symptoms that I observed from him since, well, for many years now, my professional opinion is that it was directly related to his bipolar 1 disorder. This is a question of substantial evidence, and I would submit that the Cohen deposition, just the part that I read, clearly satisfies the standard of substantial evidence linking the causation in fact.
Counsel?
Yes.
I want to take.
He would finish that sentence first.
Just a minute.
Sure.
I think he.
That this is substantial evidence linking the causation, in fact, linking that to the from the conduct that he exhibited on April 20th to his bipolar condition.
Justice Kelly?
Yes.
Thank you. I do want to address this question of timing with respect to, let's take, for example, this testimony that you've just read, and let's say it's completely and totally true. And not to be too blunt about it, but my response to that is potentially, so what? And here's why. The LURC said in its memorandum decision, quote, the weight of the evidence on this issue, which is technical and scientific and calls for expert testimony, favors a finding that Carlson's conduct on the two occasions was caused by his bipolar disorder. All right. Well, if that is technical and scientific and requires expert testimony to suss that out, what is the employer supposed to do in the moment when they're considering whether to terminate employment?
Yes, Your Honor, that's a very good question. And we have to deal with reality. As Justice Rogenczyk said, in the real world, employers have to make decisions, you know, without having a doctor on call to give an opinion about whether a medical condition was, or whether a certain conduct was caused by a medical condition. And certainly for a layman to have knowledge of such a scientific and technical piece of information is something that you'd have to say has to have an element of faith, of good faith involved. I can't say for sure, without a doubt, that some medical fact is true or not. I trust a doctor. I trust some medical opinion. And I have to do that in good faith. That's the way the world has to work. That's the way employers have to make decisions. And that was what was lacking in this case on the part of the employer. How much knowledge did the employer have? Enough. The knowledge that for over a year, Mr. Carlson had presented letters from his psychiatrist and his psychologist describing his condition, putting him on notice that he had bipolar.
Right. So let's concentrate on that for a moment.
Yeah.
So we've got the doctor's letters describing the bipolar disorder. And what I'm wondering is, are these get-out-of-jail-free cards, right?
No, so that, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So that the employee gets caught in a particular behavior, that he can just flash the letter and make the employer required to believe that his behavior is the consequence of bipolar disorder. Can he do that?
No, not at all. He's not required. What he's required to do is act in good faith, to act honestly, to accept information sincerely, and if there's a good faith question about it, to ask for further clarification. You know, the pattern for this case actually is the Target versus LURC case. It's 217 Wisconsin 2nd 1. And in that case, the fact of the matter was that the, excuse me, I don't have the right case in front of me, that what was required to prove intent, intentional discrimination, was knowledge on the part of the employer that, in this case, the employee had sleep apnea and was falling asleep on the job, and that caused a problem. She met with her employer. She said, basically, I'm seeing a doctor, and he's taking a look at things, and he's giving me an inhaler, and maybe that'll help. The employer said, well, I want some verification. And that's what the employer here could have easily said. In May, after the April 20th incident.
And wouldn't that have been in response to Mr. Carlson saying, look, this was caused by my bipolar disorder?
He, in fact, said that.
Here's some evidence of that.
Yes.
Right? I mean, because, again, we're talking about LURC itself saying that this is a complex question that requires expert testimony to determine whether, in fact, there is a connection between the disorder and the behavior in question.
It is. Yeah. And the Walmart case was the case that decided that fact. And that's the question of whether the causation, in fact, can be proven to a court. And that's one thing. Another thing, though, is what knowledge is sufficient at the employer at the time the employer makes a decision,
right.
Keeping in mind, the employer is in control of when it makes that decision. At any time in the process, the employer could ask for further clarification, ask for a doctor's letter. They didn't do that in this case. In the termination meeting, at the time of the termination meeting, you have to think of all the accumulated knowledge that the employer had regarding Mr. Carlson's
condition. Mr. Brown, I'd like to ask a question. You're about to talk about the termination meeting, but I'd like to ask you about something that happened in sequence prior to that, and that was after the 2010 incident, and as a consequence of that, Mr. Carlson agreed to sign the last chance agreement. Now, my review of the record and my recollection of the record is that, you know, he had representation, he had good representation, help from the union, and he had the opportunity to really think about these things. And the record, from what the record discloses, you know, Mr. Carlson doesn't have a problem. You know, he's an intelligent person. And I thought to myself when I read that part in the brief, I thought, well, geez, before signing a last chance agreement, and I don't think this requires thinking like a lawyer, I think this requires a little bit of planning, and he's got at least two professionals who are helping him, and he's got friends. Wouldn't you want to make a plan with the employer for how to head off or how to mitigate, shall we say, subsequent problems? And then that raises the question I have, as a matter of law, whose obligation would it be to come up with the plan to say, okay, I'll go along with this last chance agreement. I agree hanging up on 12 customers in 10 minutes isn't great, and the time I was in the wrap. Okay, but we need to come up with something because this condition is not the type that usually just goes away.
Sure.
Who has that obligation?
Well, that has been called the interactive process between the employer and the employee. When an employer becomes aware of a disability that has some effect on their work, on the quality of their work, their performance, then the parties are supposed to talk it out. It's a two-way street between the two, and determine what might be a good plan to avoid a future incident like this. Now, Mr. Carlson felt bad that he had hung up on customers. He didn't he didn't want to pursue that in any kind of way to try to get an accommodation to allow him to hang up on customers. He realized that was not good performance. And I believe, you know, my thinking is that he thought he could resolve his bipolar condition with his therapy, and hopefully that an incident like that wouldn't happen again. And sure enough, a year later, when he was spiraling into this depression, having not passed this test, he didn't hang up on customers. He didn't misbehave at all. He didn't commit any act of misconduct and didn't need to ask for an accommodation to take a partial day of absence. That's all he did. He took a partial day of absence that...
Well, that's not all he did, counsel, right? He was chatting with about a dozen to 14 other employees,
correct,
thereby impeding their ability to do their job, and he was encouraging an employee to check her test results for the job that she had applied for. I mean, this wasn't just, I can't handle my job, I'm going to, stop.
Yes, Your Honor.
So that I don't hang up on any employees like I did a year ago.
Yes, Your Honor. There was 38 minutes of his Q-chatting on the phone. First of all, though, it was in evidence from Mr. Carl that there was no disruption in performance of the work of any other caller, any other person answering calls. There was absolutely no disruption to performance on the job. Other than, of course,
counsel,
Mr. Carlson was not taking calls because he felt ill. He went and reported to his boss right after finding out he failed this test, telling his boss he didn't feel too well, he wasn't sure he was going to make it, and that his boss said, do what you need to do.
Would you agree that his disability arguably prevented him from doing his job this day?
Yes, indeed. Yes, that was a finding of fact. That day, his
And doesn't Chapter 111 allow an employer to terminate an employee even if they have a disability when that disability prevents them from doing their job?
What happens if there's conduct that's caused by a disability that interferes with the individual's ability to perform the job, and there's some discipline or some consequence that the employer imposes? Well, there are a couple of things to ask. One is, what was the nature of the conduct that the employee engaged in? Was it misconduct? Now, I would contend that it was not misconduct. The only...
Well, whether we characterize it as misconduct or not, 111.34 sub 2 sub A says it is not employment discrimination because of a disability, and I'm paraphrasing for the circumstances presented by this case, to terminate employment if the disability is reasonably related to the individual's ability to adequately undertake the job-related responsibilities of that individual's employment. I don't think Wisconsin Bell has actually raised this issue. I wonder why.
Maybe no, they're not.
Can that... address that in rebuttal. What? But here, it seems to me that Wisconsin Bell took the action it took because Mr. Carlson couldn't do his job. Maybe that was because of the disability, but they weren't firing him because of a disability,
but
were they?
Your Honor, what you're paraphrasing there is an affirmative defense that the employer failed to put on. There is no case put on by the employer that there was inadequate job performance. The reason for the firing was simple. They thought, or they said, that he was lying, that he wasn't sick that day. That's why they say they fired him, not because of his disability, but because he was sick that day. I see my time has run out.
Yes.
So thank you.
Thank you very much. Justice Rebecca Bradley, did you have enough time to ask your questions, or do you want to pick it up again with the next witness?
I did. I'll just say to other counsel that I'd appreciate having that issue addressed, and I'm not sure that the court is precluded from applying 111.34 sub 2 sub A.
May it please the court. My name is Attorney Robert Milik. I represent Charles Carlson in this case. I would like to address your question. The answer is quite simple. Mr. Carlson that day was only temporarily rendered unable to perform his job duties for a very brief period of time. When he left that day, when he put himself into health code, he did so like any other employee was entitled to do. Any other employee there, because of a cold or the flu or to use the restroom, is entitled to stop incoming calls. And Mr. Carlson, because of his bipolar disorder, couldn't do his job only temporarily. And any employee in his circumstances could have left.
Counsel, is Wisconsin Bell required to believe that that's why he put himself into health code?
Not automatically, no. And I think that some of your questions raise an excellent point here. I think we're here today because Jason Carl, the supervisor, didn't ask a very simple and obvious question. And that is, at the review board meeting that resulted in his termination, Mr. Carl had simply said to Mr. Carlson, I've read these Q-chats. I've looked through them all. How is it possible that you can Q-chat with 15 separate employees and not do your job as a customer service representative?
Mm, that would have been helpful.
That's an excellent question. It's a reasonable question.
And it would have been helpful if it was asked. Is it their responsibility to ask that question?
It is.
Why?
Because in this case, that's what resulted in his termination.
Okay. That's a little bit of bootstrappery. Tell me why it's required that they ask that question.
Because under the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act,
it is required
to provide a reasonable accommodation to an employee who may need one.
Okay. Did he ask for an accommodation?
He did not, because he did not need one. But
okay. You're going around a little bit in circles here.
Well,
so let me back up a little bit so we can escape it. So when Mr. Carlson says, I'm ill, that's why I stopped taking calls. And I asked, is Wisconsin Bell required to believe him? And you said, no, he's not. And so now take me one step at a time again.
Yes.
To how you get to Wisconsin Bell was wrong for not believing him.
Well, because when he's brought into the meeting and he's explaining now the knowledge element I think we're talking about, right? And so under the Act, that knowledge element must be established by the employee prior to the termination taking place.
Yes. Knowledge that his disorder caused the conduct.
Correct.
Okay. So what did he do to draw the line between the two?
So when he went to the meeting, he brought yet another letter from his psychiatrist.
Yes.
And during that meeting, Mr. Carlson explained, I was in health code because I was experiencing a breakthrough episode and I could not adequately perform my job duties.
Okay, stop there. Does Wisconsin Bell have to believe that?
Not necessarily.
Okay, so under what circumstances could they not believe that?
They could say, we don't believe you at all. Get something from your doctor to establish this causal connection.
Okay. Why is it Wisconsin Bell's requirement to counsel Mr. Carlson on what he must do to justify his behavior?
Because they have the issues. And again,
They have the what?
They're raising the issue with regard to the termination. And specifically, I believe that Mr. Carl's concern was, you're chew-chatting with these people, but you're telling me you have bipolar disorder. I don't believe you.
Right?
I don't believe this. So, Mr. Carlson, can you get something from your doctor tying your conduct in chew-chatting to your bipolar disorder? Because it appears to me.
So there was a hearing after that, right?
Correct.
And couldn't Mr. Carlson, represented by his union, have brought that kind of evidence to that hearing?
He did.
Did at that hearing, prior to termination,
right,
was there anybody who said his bipolar disorder caused the events on that day?
Yes.
Where's that?
It's in the record.
Can you
point to it? It was the testimony by, can I point to it directly?
Yes.
I believe it's in volume 3 at about page 530 in that area.
Okay.
Mr. Carlson's testimony. He says, I was in that meeting and I explained that my conduct was caused by my disability and that I was Q-chatting as a coping mechanism.
Right. Okay. So now it's getting back to whether Wisconsin Bell has to believe him when he says that.
True, and let me point out as well, it was also an admission by the managers that they themselves understood he was saying, I'm Q-chatting as a lifeline, as a coping mechanism. They understood that at the time.
They understood he was saying that, but I need to have you provide something to me that says, here's something that overrides Wisconsin Bell's belief that he was not telling the truth. Because that's what this is. Wisconsin Bell says, I don't believe you when you say that this was a health-related necessity. Right. So I want to have something I can point to that says, well, here, right here, there's a medical letter that says the incident on April 20 was caused by his bipolar disorder or something to that effect, so that we can look at Wisconsin Bell and say, look, you knew. I haven't seen that. Can you point to anything in the record that says that?
That specific letter that says his Q-chatting was tied to his bipolar disorder
doesn't exist.
Okay. He didn't have that at the meeting.
All right. So what do you have that would override Wisconsin Bell's statement that they simply did not believe?
Because of the bad faith that they engaged in. In order to have this honest belief that he was lying about his conduct, it's required that they interact with him in good faith to determine whether or not he's actually lying. And that was completely absent from their conduct, as found by substantial record evidence. They disregarded his efforts. Mr. Carl didn't even read the second letter from Dr. Siegel. Didn't read it.
Right. And that letter didn't say that his behavior on April 20th was caused by his condition, did it?
It did not. But the first letter from Dr. Siegel was this was not a general letter. The first letter from Dr. Siegel explained, number one, his diagnosis, and it described bipolar disorder.
Yes.
As extremes of mood that have rapid onset, triggered by relatively minor frustrations.
Right.
That describes to a T hanging up on customers and what he did by taking himself in the collar and doing health.
Which brings me back to the question I asked of Mr. Brown, which is, once you have a letter that says I have bipolar disorder, is that a get-out-of-jail-free card every time you engage in misbehavior?
Absolutely not.
Why not?
Because for two reasons. Number one, an employer does not have to tolerate misconduct when it renders the individual unable to perform their job functions. That's the affirmative defense, and that's what Lurk held with regard to the suspension. Lurk specifically examined that issue and said, when he's hanging up on callers, that's contrary to the purposes of a customer service representative. That's misconduct. An employer does not have to tolerate that. But with regard to the termination, there was no affirmative defense presented by Wisconsin Bell. None. And in fact, there couldn't have been one. Mr. Carlson did nothing wrong on April 20th, 2011.
Well, that's you say, but
Was he doing his job when he checked his test score instead of answering customer calls?
Yes, he was.
It was okay for him to check his test
score. Absolutely.
And encourage another employee to
Absolutely. There was absolutely no prohibition.
That's part of his job as well.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
There was absolutely no prohibition from him Q-chatting for personal reasons. That's established in the record. All of those employees would Q-chat regularly about where they're going to lunch.
I'm not talking about the Q-chatting. I'm talking about him independently as an individual checking his test score when he has a bipolar disorder. And shouldn't he maybe have thought, gosh, if this is bad news, I might have an episode given my bipolar disorder?
Well, I suppose that, you know, an individual with bipolar disorder is going to have a very difficult time trying to navigate through life and avoid every potential issue that's going to trigger bipolar, an episode. I mean, this is a very unpredictable illness.
Let me ask something related to the incident of the 2011 matter.
Yes.
You kind of skipped over the incident itself. You mentioned a little bit about it, but then you went to the review board hearing. When I was reading about it, I thought to myself, well, he's only, I think he was only 10 days away from being out from under that last chance agreement that he had signed. And I already shared, it doesn't matter. If you're signing a last chance agreement, you're kind of acknowledging that there's real problems.
Yes.
Be that as it may, the part that caught my attention about the second incident when he's, I don't know what Q chatting is. Let's just call it instant messaging.
Fair enough.
And he's talking to his supervisor, he's talking to his union rep, and what he's doing is spending a great deal of time going over, gee, what's the impact on my, is it going to be a tardy, is it going to be an occurrence, because I can handle one on the disciplinary record, I can't. That shows, to me, that shows someone who's got enough on the ball and with intelligence to be concerned about the future. And I thought to myself, well, gee, you know this other thing just happened not too long ago. You know you're under a last chance agreement. You've had contact with a supervisor. Why not tell them? Why not tell the supervisor, or there's got to be someone. He was an employee there for like 26 years, I believe.
24.
Okay. 24, almost a quarter of a century. There had to be someone. I speculate. But whoever's responsible for discipline and supervision that day, he was not on. You're saying people are allowed to use the instant messaging for personal thing, but he was on a health code, and you're correct in your observations that there are no set policies for time limits, but I believe there are policies for proper uses of the health code, and that's mainly to use the restroom and then to see, I think the employer has a nurse or a nurse's station there.
No, that's not in the record.
Or to deal with whatever is causing an illness.
An employee can utilize health code when they're legitimately sick. Mr. Carlson was legitimately sick when he put
himself But isn't there, within that, isn't there sort of an expectation that you're going to, wouldn't you expect two things? For him to take affirmative steps to address the illness that he testified later to he was suffering. So he's got self-awareness, he testified later, about things that could only be possible for him to truthfully testify to if he had self-awareness at the time. So he's got self-awareness, I infer, my unlearned opinion, at the time of the second incident. He knows he's under the last chance agreement. He knows that he just had the prior incident. He knows he's on thin ice. Why not reach out to someone in a position of responsibility and instead of just saying, I'm out of here, say, look, I'm having a real, we could use a lawyer, like I'm having a manifestation of my illness, but I'm not capable. I need something right now.
Because at the time, he did what he was expected to do under and complied with their policies. He put himself into health code. He reported to his supervisor that he wasn't doing well and said, I think I'm going to go home. And she said,
but he wasn't doing well because of the test scores, not about the mental illness.
That subject of the test scores didn't come up. He just said, I'm not doing well. But the answer to your question is because no employee was required to have to go and say, this is the specific reason why I can't work. I've been vomiting. I'm sick. I just learned terrible news of a car accident. No employee needed to do that. All they needed to do was have a legitimate illness. They don't have to make a case. And if I see that my time is up.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, I'm Jeffrey Shampo. I represent the Labor and Industry Review Commission, and we reserved 5 minutes just to talk about the deference issue if it came up again. The point I would like to make is that while this is a 227 case, so now we're outside Chapter 102, we're in the General Administrative Procedure Act, the holding in Borgnes v. Falk, and that was the 1911 case that said that the Workers' Compensation Act didn't unconstitutionally vest judicial power in the commission. That has some application in 227 cases. And when Borgnes was written, the court prefaced its remarks by saying, there are many administrative boards or commissions. With the increasing complexity of modern government, they seem likely to increase rather than diminish. Examples may be easily thought of, town boards, boards of health, boards of review, boards of equalization. And the point I'm trying to make is, the court wasn't just limiting its holding to Chapter 102 when it said that commissions or boards could be given great dignity and force so that their conclusions couldn't be reversed unless the proof was clear and satisfactory against them. I think it's important to keep in mind, even though that's a 102 case, it does have some application in 227. And the other...
Counsel, I'm going to interrupt you because you're the last speaker on that side, according to my notes. I expected a lot of discussion about the inference method. And I don't, maybe I missed it, but I haven't heard it. So I want to know what your position is on the inference method. And that's a method used to define or apply the because of language in the statute. So first, tell me what the inference method is in your opinion, because I'm not sure that everybody's using the same language to describe inference method. And then tell me whether it applies or doesn't apply, et cetera.
With your permission, I'd like to defer that to Mr. Brown. He's much more versed in it. You'll probably get a better answer.
It's okay Thank with you. Me. I don't care who. You've got a limited time on that side of the podium, and... all I need is,
because okay, thank you, Your
that's
Honor.
One reason we took this case.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. And I understand your confusion about the term inference method, because I think it's been applied interchangeably to two different things. One is the simple process of inferring facts, inferring conclusions from disputed issues of fact. In this case, the commission inferred discriminatory intent based on the facts of the case. That's not anything special. That's just what every fact finder does when they hear disputed facts and make conclusions.
Well, you can't open somebody's mind and find intent. So you have to find intent from the
Correct.
Evidence.
Correct. It has to be inferred. People don't tell their intents often.
Well, but you don't believe them necessarily, even if they do, right? Because they're going to find an intent
Correct.
That satisfies their particular position.
Correct. So all the facts and circumstances have to be looked at, and that's the function of the fact finder. That's the function of LURC when they decide that there was knowledge and motivation in this case to let Mr. Carlson go because of his disability. The other thing that's been referred to as inference method is this particular thing that I would call a logical inference or a syllogism, which is basically this, that an employer discharges a person for conduct, and that conduct is shown to be a product of a disability, then, logically, the employer has discharged the person because of the disability.
Or because they were unable to do the job.
Well, either one would apply. It would certainly be both, perhaps.
But or Chapter 113 excuses the employer. It okays the employer's termination decision, even if it has knowledge of the disability, if the individual employee cannot do the job, even if they can't do the job because of the disability.
Yes, but again, remember, the employer did not fire Mr. Carlson because it said he couldn't do his job. They didn't fire him because they said your disability makes it your performance inadequate. They fired him because they thought he was lying about going home ill on a particular day.
Mr. Brown, how does the inference theory hold up if instead of bipolar depressive, we're talking about psychotic, antisocial?
And the
fact is not just a hold or a health hold or a wrap, but God forbid, you know, a murder at the work site. And it's caused by the mental illness.
Absolutely.
Therefore, they fired him for the mental illness. So benefits, according
to
you?
That's exactly what the affirmative defense is for. If someone commits a murder on the work premises because of a disability, the employer is well within its rights to fire that employee for inadequate job performance. That's simple. That's in the law. The employer is protected absolutely against misconduct committed by an employee, even if that misconduct is caused by a disability.
Chief Justice, may I ask a final question?
If it's required.
It's to address, I think, a potential flaw in the logic of this syllogism. I looked at that carefully, and I'm not sure that it works. I restructured your causal chain into the form of a syllogism, and it goes like this. The major premise is that it is unlawful for Wisconsin Bell to terminate a person's employment because of his disability. The minor premise is Mr. Carlson was terminated after exhibiting behavior consistent with his disability. Lurk's conclusion was Wisconsin Bell terminated Mr. Carlson's employment because of his disability. But do you see a problem there? There is no linkage between the major and minor premises with respect to
the Yes, Your Honor. The inference method, as what I've just described as being conduct, if a person is an employer discharges an employee for conduct and the conduct is caused by the disability, then the employer is terminated because of the disability. That's not the end of the issue. That's not a theory of liability. That's just a causation. That's just proving that there's a causal link between the Employers Act and the discharge, because the discharge is due to his conduct on the job. So I'm sorry, I'm getting fumbled up, but the issue is there are two aspects in order for liability to attach. One is that there be this causation, this conduct caused by the disability. Also, though, there has to be knowledge on the part of the employer, and that's what finishes the case for liability. If an employer acts knowing that the employee has committed some conduct that's due to his disability, then there's liability. Now, what knowledge is, that's a difficult question. It depends on the facts of each case, and in this case, I submit that the employer had sufficient knowledge to avoid a bad faith decision to go ahead and discharge this person.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Would you set the clock for rebuttal so she gets 7 minutes so you can have a little bit of extra time since the court ran over with the lawyer on the other side?
Thank you, Your Honor.
At the outset, we uphold findings of fact unless they're clearly erroneous. Finding a fact in number 24, I'm going to read part of it and then tell me why it's clearly erroneous and we should not be upholding it. It says in part, Carlson's mood and his inability to work on April 20th, 2011, upon learning that he failed the collections test, were caused by his bipolar disorder. The Q-chats he engaged in were reflective of his mood disorder and were consistent with his psychotherapist's recommendation that he reach out to others for support as a means of coping with his mood. There's another sentence, and then finally it says, he was unable to work because of symptoms of his mental illness and appropriately used the health code and sick leave just as it was available to any sick employee. Tell me why finding a fact 24 is clearly erroneous.
If it's based on the deposition testimony, it's probably not clearly erroneous. But it's irrelevant for the timing reason, which is that is not information Wisconsin Bell had at the time it made the termination decision at issue. It's really important that this case is not a denial of accommodation case.
Just for clarification, so you are saying, help me a little bit with this. Is 24 clearly, finding a fact 24 clearly erroneous, or is it not?
It's not clearly erroneous based on the treater's deposition testimony that came in after the fact.
But it's irrelevant.
But it's irrelevant.
So it's true, but irrelevant.
Correct.
So how can an employer ever defend against the inference method?
Well, the employer, if the inference method is, as Justice Kelly just described, is simply all you have to show is I have a condition, I had behavior, the behavior is caused by the condition, boom, liable. And if I murdered my coworker and it's because I'm a psychotic, then the employer would be liable under the inference method as Lurk has been describing that test for many, many years. That's why the test, that inference method is fundamentally flawed and is not a proper interpretation of the statute.
But Mr. Brown says that my hypothetical about the murder would not be a violation of the inference because that would be misconduct for which the employer would be entitled to discharge the employee.
And I think the difference is, in that scenario, the employer is on notice and is told, okay, the employee murdered his coworker because he's a psychotic, and here's the proof of that. In this case, the employer, Wisconsin Bell, did not have proof at the time it made the decision of the causal connection between the conduct and the condition, which is why we didn't assert the affirmative defense. Wisconsin, the manager's viewpoint was, we don't believe what he's saying. He avoided work, there's no question about it. He left early, he knew the disciplinary consequences, and now he's trying to say a month later it was because of his bipolar disorder. We don't believe it. And so we didn't take the position, oh, the conduct was reasonably related to the disability and have that defense, which might have triggered the accommodation obligation. This, again, is an intentional discrimination case, not an accommodation case. So while Lurk might disagree with Wisconsin Bell's view and say, you know, we don't agree that you were making a correct judgment about Mr. Carlson's mental health that day, that's not Lurk's job.
But Mr. Carlson's attorney argued that there was no misconduct on the second incident, that he used the health code as it was intended, and that he used it. What's your response to that?
The health code wasn't used as it's intended. He used the health code to Q-chat with a bunch of coworkers. He also told a coworker who wasn't disabled to use the code herself to avoid work and check her scores. The health code is, if you can't do your job, you go into the health code, you leave, you go to the bathroom or whatever it is you need to take care of. He was using it to avoid work, talk about this test, encourage his coworker to do the same thing.
You're doing really is you're saying that his employer didn't believe him, so therefore, and because he may have been having a medical issue, but because the employer didn't believe him, that's the end of the story. It doesn't seem to me that that's what the statute is all about. I mean, you know, if truly he didn't believe him, but he's maintaining, I'm leaving because I'm ill, it seems to me it's a risky position for the employer to say, well, God bless you, we're firing you anyway because we don't believe you.
It would be if Mr. Carlson had submitted a doctor's note that said, Mr. Carlson described to me what happened that day.
He wouldn't have one in his pocket that day. And nothing is going to satisfy you timing-wise. I mean, you had the information at the hearing. Why bother with the hearing if the testimony doesn't count for anything?
This was round two for him. He used notes last time that got himself a back-to-work agreement. And that's another critical fact. This is an employer who, when they were told he had bipolar disorder that caused him to hang up on customers, they brought him back to work. That's against an inference of a company firing him because he has bipolar disorder. So if Wisconsin Bell had gotten a letter that said it was caused, yes, that would have been a risky proposition because then you could say, well, could the managers really have honestly believed that he was making it up.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether they honestly believed he was making it up or not. What matters is the employer just shut down the process because they honestly believed it. He may be honestly reporting, I'm over the top. It just seems to me you leave no room for the employee if the manager can disbelieve, and that's the end of the story.
But as counsel said, he didn't need an accommodation. He didn't ask for an accommodation. If this was an accommodation scenario, that does trigger an interactive dialogue. But that's not the claim before this court.
Okay. Well, thank you.
And you're talking about, you're focusing on the date of the event, I believe, the second event. That if there had been, that if he had mentioned, if he had sought out some assistance to say, hey, remember that time about a year ago when I had a problem, and then we came up with this last chance agreement, which, gee, I'm only 10 days away from being out, then you're saying the word, the phrase you just used, that would have triggered something like the obligation of a dialogue.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor, and that's the Target Stores case that counsel for Lurk mentioned. That's the clemency and forbearance case where an employee came forward and said, you know what, I'm falling asleep on the job, but it's because I have a medical condition that's being evaluated, and I just don't know. And in that situation, the Court of Appeals said, you know what, the employer had to wait and see. That's not this case, one, because that's not what was asked for by Mr. Carlson, and two, we don't have an accommodation claim before the court.
Okay. Thank you very much. Well, it's a very interesting case, and the briefing was quite good, and the argument, too, was very good. We are going to take a break, and the court will meet at 3:20, and Justice Abrahamson, I think the students left. Is that right, Kevin? Okay, so you don't need to come back out then. I guess
we
have buses, and it's sometimes hard to keep people here. In any case, we are adjourned. Thank you.